We finished up looking at stories, the most popular kind of literature in the Bible. We want to turn now to poetry, very common in the Bible as well. You know, poetry's fallen on hard times, hasn't it? Years ago, back in the 1800s, for example, and 1700s and way back, poetry was so popular, so crucial for people to have and to talk about. You had people like Tennyson. In this country, you had Longfellow. They were like rock stars of their time period. If they came to town, everybody went. People wanted to know what they were up to. People cared about poetry. And somewhere between then and now, poetry is gone. We just have little enclaves of it, mostly in colleges, it seems like. We have a small band of poets writing to another small band of poets. We have small circulation poetry magazines. It rarely appears in national journals, unless it's ridicule kind of poetry and real basic sort of stuff. So it's gone. I've got a lot of ideas as to why, but I think we'll move on. I'll tell you one thing. We are in, I think it's the Sesame Street world, and no offense to Sesame Street, but everything has to be quick pace. It has to be flashy. It has to move from one thing to the next. Poetry asks you to do just the opposite. It asks you to slow down. It asks you to think. It asks you to meditate. And we're not a meditating kind of people, so we've lost that along the way. But why don't we take a look today just at poetry in general, get an idea of what the characteristics are of a lot of poetry. And I thought we could start by looking at Psalm 1. I think we read it before when we were talking about part of the Bible, going through it the first time. But let me read it. It's so short. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked. They're like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Now, in class, what I ask the students to do is to find a piece that I wrote that is a prose version. In other words, it's a translation into prose from poetry of that same psalm, just to see what gets lost and what some of the characteristics are of poetry. So here is my example that I wrote up. This is Psalm 1, but it's the poetry has been stripped out of it. It's been turned into what you might find in an encyclopedia, what you might find online in Wikipedia or something like that. Just basic language, but it says the same thing. So the language has not changed. It's the characteristics of the poetry that have been stripped out of it. Here we go. I call it a ruined version of Psalm 1. It's good for people if they don't hang around bad individuals. Good people should meditate a lot on God and His law. They will prosper if they continue to do this. But bad people have no depth of character and will eventually be separated from God and righteous people. The future looks better for the righteous than for the wicked. Now, I think I've done a good job getting the main ideas across. I think I've ruined it, but I think I've done a good idea. And let's look at what the characteristics are of the poem that makes it superior, or at least makes it different than a simple short paragraph summary. So I would say one of the things you probably noticed immediately is that poetry is set up in lines rather than all the way to the edge of the page and so on. For example, mine says, "Blessed is the man," and then there's a break. Well, there's a lot of space there. That sentence could have continued if it was done as prose. And it shifts down to another line, "Who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked." Then there's a break. New line. "Or stand in the way of sinners." New line. "Or sit in the seat of mockers." "But his delight is in the law of the Lord." New line. "And on his law he meditates day and night." So something's going on here. Would you agree that by doing these lines, I think what happens is it slows us down. We don't get that smooth reading that we talk about when you take a reading improvement class that says start moving your eyes faster across the page. You can't. The page, in this case, the line comes to an end so fast, we have to gather ourselves and start in again. And so I think that's on purpose. I think it's important to know what words start and what words end the lines, because they will become key words here. For example, line one, blessed is a certain kind of man. What is this man? Well, he gets a separate line, the one who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. And that's separated from what else he might do wrong or stand in the way of sinners. Notice we end up with wicked, we end up with sinners. And what's the third thing that he might do? Brand new line. Or sit in the seat of mockers. But, so I like that transition. But, new line, his delight is in what? The end of that line, that gets emphasis in the law of the Lord. And on his law he meditates, how often? Day and night. Is that true? No. We'll talk about what the person is up to by writing it that way. So you've got lines that immediately require you to do different things. You have key words that pop out at you that would be lost if it was in a typical prose line. Did you notice the difference, too, between my version and what you had here in Psalm 1? Psalm 1 is far more concrete. You could picture it. There were sights and there were all sorts of great images in there. You know, for example, a tree, and it's planted by streams of water, and the leaf doesn't wither, and the wicked are like chaff, and you got the wind blowing them away. I mean, you can picture that sort of stuff. You could not picture anything that I said. For example, they will prosper, right? Talking about good people, they will prosper. Is there any picture of prospering? No. I said bad people have no depth of character. What does that mean? Can you get any visual picture in your mind? Any mental image come to mind? No. So it says the future looks better. You know, the Lord watches over the way of the righteous is what Psalm 1 said. So it's more concrete. And one of the ways that a poem works that my version did not work at all was using something called figures of speech. There are some comparisons made. Now, you probably picked up on that really easily. Verse 3, he is like. So we're going to get a comparison. A man is something like a tree. You say, wow, how's that possible? We're nothing like trees. We think, we move, we damage much more easily than trees. But if you think about it and you read this thing, there is a comparison there, isn't there? We're like a tree. What kind of tree? Planted by streams of water. Notice, it's nothing we do, is it? Somebody plants us, and we're by streams of water. We're dependent on those streams. We can't say, well, I don't like where I am, I'm going to go somewhere else. And it yields fruit in season. If we've ever had a fruit tree, we know how exciting that is when it starts getting that fruit and it starts growing, and we're happy to see that. The leaf does not wither. I've seen enough withered leaves that I get discouraged with things in my yard, so I know how bad that makes me feel. But that's not the case of this one. The wicked, they're just not wicked. They're like chaff. They're light. They're lightweights. There's nothing to them. They just blow away. And so those are figures of speech. Those are comparisons that are being made that allow us to mentally picture this. And it has much more of an impact than to say bad people have no depth of character. We have nothing to picture. There's no solidity to that description there. The other thing I'd say about poetry is far more concentrated, isn't it? A lot is being said in a very few lines. And there seems to be some kind of a pattern or rhythm going on there. When we get things like, who does not walk or stand or sit. And you see the man is like this, but the wicked are like something else. And therefore, the wicked will not do this, or sinners do this. And then we get that last thing that seems like a nice teeter-totter back and forth. The Lord watches over one group, and something bad's going to happen to the other group. So there are some patterns, and we'll talk about what all these things are. We'll even talk about particular figures of speech later on in the semester. But I just want you to notice the difference between these two things, doing something in poetry and doing something in prose. And heavens, it's so much better in poetry. There's a saying that I came across I thought was useful. It says, poetry tries to approach the universal or the conceptual through the particular or the concrete. Now, that's a mouthful, but let's go back. Poetry tries to approach the universal or the conceptual. In other words, poetry tries to deal with ideas. It tries to deal with big statements of life and people. But how does it do that? Not through being vague, like my ruined version of the psalm. It tries to express that through particular concrete things that we can wrap our minds around and picture and begin to understand far better. Let me take you one other place, just to have you thinking about the difference between prose and poetry. If you go back to Judges, the book of Judges, Judges 4 and Judges 5, what you have here, and I think I may have mentioned when we were talking about this briefly before, when we were just reading through the Bible, Judges 4 is the story of one of these people who was a charismatic tribal leader. In this case, a woman. Can you imagine how tough she must have been to have the Jewish tribes depending on her? And so we have this woman named Deborah. And it says she finds out that there's a battle coming. And there's a man named Sisera. And he had 900 iron chariots. And he'd been oppressing the Israelites for 20 years. And they're crying to God for help. Does this sound familiar? This is that cyclical history that I mentioned before in Judges. The people are oppressed, they cry out, a deliverer comes, they knock down their enemy, they're happy for a while, and then they fall into sin again, and they ignore God, and pretty soon they're in trouble again, enslaved, and then God sends them another judge, tribal leader, to help them out. So in this case, she sends Barak to actually be the army leader, and they have a battle. Barak is defeated. And this is roughly chapter 4, verses 14 and all. Barak goes down. He has 10,000 men with him. It says the Lord routed Sisera, verse 15. And Sisera abandoned his chariot, and he's now just fleeing for his life. He's lost the battle. And Barak is pursuing the enemy, and so Sisera is running like crazy. And verse 17, he flees on foot to the tent of a woman, Jael. And there was some kind of friendly relationship between the Sisera person and the leader and the clan where this woman is. And Jael, though, is a strong follower of the Israelite God. And she says, "What would you like?" And he says, "I'm thirsty," and he's exhausted from this battle. And he just collapses, goes to sleep. And she comes up to him in verse 21, picks up a tent peg and a hammer, and drives this peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. Yeah, no kidding. And so when Barak comes by pursuing Sisera, she says, "I'll show you the man you're looking for." And there he is, dead. So that's the prose account. It's pretty straightforward. I would say it's not highly emotional. It just simply relates to us the story of the battle and the outcome at the end of the battle. All right, well, right next door, which I think is really interesting, is a poem that takes on the same event. And the poet here, I think, is far more imaginative. I find it an extremely interesting poem. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to read it and see if you notice some of the differences from what I just said. So this is a song. This is called The Song of Deborah. Verse 2 of chapter 5, Judges. "When the princes in Israel take the lead, when the people willingly offer themselves, praise the Lord. Hear this, you kings, listen, you rulers. I will sing to the Lord, I will sing. I will make music to the Lord, the God of Israel. O Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the land of Edom, the earth shook, the heavens poured, the clouds poured down water, the mountains quaked before the Lord, the one of Sinai, before the Lord, the God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the roads were abandoned. Travelers took to winding paths. The village life in Israel ceased until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. When they chose new gods, war came to the city gates, and not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with Israel's princes, with the willing volunteers among the people. Praise the Lord. You who ride on white donkeys sitting on your saddle blankets, and you who walk along the road, consider the voice of the singers at the watering places. They recite the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts of his warriors in Israel. Then the people of the Lord went down to the city gates. Wake up! Wake up, Deborah! Wake up! Wake up! Break out in song! Arise, O Barak! Take captive your captives, O son of Abinoam! Then the men who were left came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came to me with the mighty. Some came from Ephraim, whose roots were in Amalek. Benjamin was with the people who followed you. From Machir, captains came down. From Zebulun, those who bear a commander's staff. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah. Yes, Issachar was with Barak, rushing after him into the valley. In the districts of Reuben, there was much searching of heart. Why did you stay among the campfires to hear the whistling for the flocks? In the districts of Reuben, there was much searching of heart. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan, and Dan, why did he linger by the ships? Asher remained on the coast and stayed in his coves. The people of Zebulun risked their very lives. So did Naphtali on the heights of the field. Kings came, they fought. The kings of Canaan fought at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo, but they carried off no silver, no plunder. From the heavens the stars fought, from their courses they fought against Sisera. The river Kishon swept them away, the age-old river, the river Kishon. March on, my soul, be strong. Then thundered the horse's hoofs, galloping, galloping go his mighty steeds. Curse Meraz, said the angel of the Lord, curse its people bitterly, because they did not come to help the Lord. To help the Lord against the mighty. Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, most blessed of tent-dwelling women. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. In a bowl fit for nobles, she brought him curdled milk. Her hand reached for the tent peg, her right hand for the workman's hammer. She struck Sisera, she crushed his head, she shattered and pierced his temple. At her feet he sank, he fell, there he lay. At her feet he sank, he fell, where he sank, there he fell, dead. Through the window peered Sisera's mother. Behind the lattice, she cried out, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why is the clatter of his chariots delayed? The wisest of her ladies answer her. Indeed, she keeps saying to herself, are they not finding and dividing the spoils, a girl or two for each man? Colorful garments as plunder for Sisera? Colorful garments embroidered? Highly embroidered garments for my neck? All this as plunder? So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but may they who love you be like the sun when it rises in its strength. So that's the end of that poem. If we go back and think about what you saw in chapter 4 and compare it with chapter 5, I'm assuming you notice a lot of differences. What are some of the ones that struck me? Well, there's a lot of use of that figurative language. We will talk about that later, what kinds of figures of speech. I see references to history there, references to a lot of geographical lands. There's a lot of what we call hyperbole. It's exaggeration here. The clouds pouring down water, and the roads are abandoned. The travelers took to winding paths. It's like everybody got wiped out or off the roads because of these bad people that were there. I doubt that that was that bad, but that exaggeration hammers us and makes us feel more emotional about this situation. And she calls out to the various tribes, where Dan? Where were you, Dan? And Asher. So the tribes become persons. They're personified, aren't they? And some of the tribes came and fought, and some of them did not. So, again, there's so much there to look at. The way the lines work, things like, hear this, you kings, listen, you rulers. I will sing to the Lord, I will sing. Do you hear the repetition going on there? There's a lot of excitement, a lot of joy. There's some symbolism there. You who ride on white donkeys. I think that's a particular group of people, probably the wealthy that they're talking about there. The patterns, the repetition. When we get to the part with Jael, I wanted to look at that especially. Most blessed of women be Jael. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. She brought him curdled milk, so she's brought the best that she has. And then I can almost see this as a movie. Verse 26, her hand reaches for the tent peg. Can't you see that? He collapses there. We see her moving her hand stealthily there. Her right hand is moving for the hammer. And then it takes the second half of 26, all of 27, for Sisera to be hit and die. And yet we know it must have happened in just an instant. But I think it's very effective here because it's repetition, almost like a slow motion sort of thing. At least that's the way it strikes me. She crushes his head. She shattered and pierced his temple, and he sinks, he falls, he lies, he sinks, he falls dead. I mean, I could just see a slow collapse. It took a verse and a half because this is concentrated. They want you to slow down here. They want you to see this death of this hated enemy of the Jews. And I think that's got some real power to it. So these two poems, Psalm 1 and Judges 5, will at least begin to get you feeling and thinking about poetry, that it goes through your gut. It tries to hit you in the stomach. It tries to be emotional. It tries to allow you to picture things, to get involved with what's being talked about. It manipulates language. It's a very concentrated kind of writing. And today we're not interested in that. We want things in a hurry. We get on the internet. We want our news chop chop right now. And poetry says, no, slow down. Savor the language. Enjoy it. It's the opposite of fast food. This is slow food. You want to take your time as you're going through it. So that's an introduction, at least, to poetry. Next time we'll take a look at some of the actual devices that the poets are able to use.